This interview is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. In Practice is an independent publisher, and all opinions expressed by guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of In Practice.
Engine repair, my favourite topic.
Engine repair does seem to be your favourite topic of late. We're going to be talking about FTAI today. How did you come across this business?
Also known as FTAI. FTAI. Well, I came across it about 18 months too late, clearly, which is kind of typical of me lately.
seems to be a habit.
Stock is like 5x over the last 18 months. No, I've been following GE and Safran and for years, and specifically the CFM56 engine, which is, I think, nearly 40% of all commercial engines globally. So it's the largest engine program by 2 to 3x, I think. And so I've always been studying the OEMs. I mean, they dominate the market so much. Obviously, the engine's the most expensive part or subsystem on an aircraft. So understanding the engines and how the OEMs behave is also critical to understand. Companies like Heiko, who may PMA or replicate and compete with some of the parts on the engine. So I've always been aware of, I've always been following GE and Safran and engines, and looked at various engine MRO shops like MTU, and I'd briefly heard of Fortress Infrastructure, which was the previous kind of name of the company. And specifically because it was working with Chromalloy to do a HPT blade PMA, which is a critical part in the hot section of the CFM56. Yeah, so came across it basically late after it was, you know, after they changed the name and really started to ramp their MRO business. But I mean, just a brief introduction. So FTAI, they previously owned a bunch of infrastructure assets that they spun out. Historically been an aircraft lease and engine leasing business. And the current shape of the business was pretty much formed during COVID, when no one was flying. So the aftermarket RPMs declined massively and no one was flying. So all the engines and the aircraft are grounded. FTAI, with the capital that they had via Fortress. So FTAI is the old Fortress Infrastructure entity, backed by Fortress, spun out of Fortress. They had a bunch of capital, not only from Fortress, but also from the assets they sold. And they ended up just buying a bunch of these CFM56s. So they were buying them fairly cheaply and buying a lot of them where either aircraft was retiring or being grounded, and airlines and aircraft owners, fleet owners needed cash. FTAI were buying up a bunch of these in COVID. And effectively then they have entered the market, you know, the engine MRO market for the largest engine program, which is the CFM56. And they bought a Lockheed facility, which has capabilities to do core and just engine repair and test engines. And so they've effectively segued into becoming the largest owner of CFM56s and one of the largest, if not the largest, MRO shop for CFM56s. So I came across the business like from the PMA angle, and then really kind of started to get really more interested to understand what they're doing with engine MRO. They, you know, call it their module factory, which is that they have this module swap or modular repair strategy towards the 56, which at least is somewhat unique as a third party to, you know, as a service provider to other airlines. Lufthansa and Delta and some of the bigger airlines have been doing this for a while. You know, we can get into the module swap and the design of an engine later, but they're effectively now offering a pretty unique, you know, fairly cheap and efficient way to repair engines at the Lockheed facility via the module swap strategy that they have. And so now you have two businesses at FTAI, which is one is an aircraft and engine leasing business where they own a $2 billion book value, roughly 50-50 split between engines and aircraft. They lease those out to customers, and they also own 450 CFMs, which they also lease out on that aircraft and separately, and also they maintain these. So the part of the offering which is unique is that as an airline, you can go to FTAI and you can pretty much get a plane and engine
and they do all your maintenance. You don't have to worry about anything. Whereas typically airlines, you know, they don't want to worry about their own maintenance. They just want to put bums on seats, you know, and fly them. So yeah, I came in via the PMA from the work we've done in Hayeco historically. How much we know about Hayeco and the PMA business was following it from the chrome alloy PMA, which is interesting, which recently got approved, and then started to really dig in when I realized that, you know, this module swap factory and their strategy was pretty unique and also growing pretty quickly, right? So their airlines are adopting this.
So we've published 3 pieces of long form work, IP research work, that is, our curated synthesis pieces built on your readings of the filings and a series of interviews with operators in the field over, and this will be now probably, it's a couple years of work that you've done on engines and then more recently focused on FTAI specifically. Talk about your process in surfacing the hypotheses that you decided to test that made their way into these curated pieces. So a company learning journey, that's one format that we published that summarizes all the work we've ever done on this business and the industry in which it operates in, or the part of the market in which it operates. We then have a couple of research analysis pieces focusing on the module swap offering and focusing on chrome alloy and the CFM56 HPT blade PMA. So your hypotheses, how you came up with those hypotheses?
Well, I mean, like I said, I was following the HPT PMA because there have been historical HPT blades that have been PMA'd by chrome alloy that have done pretty well. So that was one hypothesis, like how attractive is this HPT blade PMA that Fortress is launching as a JV with chrome alloy. Part of the investment thesis of FTAI was really built up. If you go back and look at the historical communications management, it was largely built around that because everyone looks at Hayeco, and Hayeco is obviously, you know, one of the best industrial performers over the last 30, 40 years. Their PMA shop, the largest PMA shop globally, you know, and it's a pretty decent business. So a lot of the investors that I spoke to and stuff that, you know, the long case was built around that PMA because, you know, typically a HPT blade brand new from GE is like 20K, you know, and there's 70 odd blades in a core section, on a hot section of a CFM56. It's like the most expensive part in the engine, and it gets worn and cracked, and because it's the where you have the air and the gas kind of moving in the combustor quickly, so you get a lot of wear and tear, and you get a replacement of these quite often. So if you're going to PMA anything, this is the part to PMA. And also then, if you think about the module swap business, Fortress can use this PMA to reduce the cost to their customers. So instead, if I'm an airline and I'm going into Fortress's, you know, I'm going to Lockheed facility owned by Fortress to repair my engine, I put my engine in, they look at the three modules, open the core section up, you know, I've got a whole set of HPT blades I need to repair or replace. If I can't repair them, because most of them can't be repaired, if I want to go replace them, I have to go to GE and pay a couple $1 million, right? And also they might not even be available potentially. So having a PMA in stock with a different supply chain than GE, that was what everyone was excited about, you know, a few years ago. And obviously then you have the history of Hayeco. Hayeco started with engine PMAs. It's a big PMA shop, high margins in the aftermarket, like attractive business. So understanding the PMA, you know, how airlines will adopt this. Why would they adopt this? This is a risky part, right? If you're going to put a foreign object in the words of the OEM, GE doesn't want you to put FTAI's or chrome alloy's part in their own engine. You know, you lose the warranty. The GE won't deal with you if something goes wrong, et cetera, et cetera. Why and how would airlines adopt this was one part of the hypotheses to test and to understand more about that HPT blade, how they work, how much, you know, the repair versus replacement rate, cost of them, difference in the historicals of the PMA. That was kind of one whole section which we published on. The other hypothesis to test was then, you know, the kind of adjacent story, which was, okay, if they do get this PMA, you know, part of the discussion from F-time management is that they can pretty much earn $1 million per module, and that's a large amount relative to other MRO shops. Part of that is from the PMA, but also part of that is from how efficient they are in their module swap strategy. So the other huge part of the work was, the majority of the work, frankly, was on just really understanding what is a module swap. Like, take me through, I'm an airline, I've got an engine. Okay, I buy it on day one, it's brand new. I fly it for how many hours? Shop one visit, shop two visit. You know, what are the repairs likely on this engine? LPT, core, fan, different modules, different cycles, different repair and replacement rate per module. How does that work? You know, and just really going through it step by step to understand how the engine operates and why, you know, this company, which is spun up an asset manager, can supposedly earn superior margins than any other MRO shop that has existed before. And that's pretty much the essence of the work on the module swap.
Let's get into some of the specific people that you spoke to, and in particular, the approach to sourcing for this project, how you worked with Adrian.
It's an interesting business because there's not that many people. I mean, it's a $20 billion enterprise value business now, right? After the stock has gone nuts, but there's less than 200 people who work there. Like, it's a few hundred people who work there, right? They have lots of partnerships. Obviously, they've outsourced the PMA stuff to Chromalloy. They work with AR and distribution. But fundamentally, there's a bunch of people that spun out of Fortress that started this, in the 5 years ago. So we obviously wanted to speak to people who were directly involved in module swaps. You know, if you think about the process for FTIDES, they've got to buy these engines from somewhere, right? So end of life aircraft, or, you know, whenever they're retiring aircraft, or people want to sell, switch engines, FTI come in and buy these big packages of engines. So understanding how the engine book value, what is the price they pay for an engine, how that then comes into their fleet. And they have 450 CFMs, three modules each. How do they manage this process of matching different modules with different engines as customers come in? That's a pretty complicated process, because if you think about an engine, if you're Ryanair and you're flying Dublin to London, that's a completely different environment. The air, the moisture, the weather, etc., humidity, the height, the altitude, etc. They could do it in the Middle East, right? It's dusty, or in America. So every engine's different. Every module has different cycles, different environment. Understanding how you can match and switch and swap these modules per engine for different customers is critical. So part of that was figuring out who's actually working on these engines, who's actually touching them, operating them, who understands them, who can walk me through every single part of the module. I think one potential insight that came out of the work was that every module is different, every engine is different. And the way that management kind of explain it is that they don't tell you really which modules they have. And so they'll tell you they have X number of engines, but they won't tell you which modules people are actually buying. Because you have an LPT, a core, and a fan in an engine. And the core is it's the core of it. It's the hot section. It's where the money is. It's where the risk is. If you open up the core and you start trying to switch out and repair, you know, there's certain requirements, the FAA requirements and OEM repair manual requirements that increase the cost of maintenance. And the engine book value is just a reflection of the maintenance cost to maintain the engine. That's what drives the book value, really. So what FTI don't tell you is how much of the work and the risk, where they're earning their money, frankly. They say it's engine repair, but there's various different types of engine repair. You know, and so part of the understanding was, or the task for us was to understand which modules are being sold when and how, and which airlines demand certain modules, and how that can define the real opportunity for FTI. because I guess we come into looking at this business when it was already stock was 2-3 x up. It's already $20 billion enterprise value business, slightly levered, and it's not trading at a hugely crazy valuation, but it's certainly not cheap. And if it is to grow into its valuation, then there has to be a certain demand of these modules out there from airlines. So understanding where that demand comes from is critical. And like I said, the demand for each module and engine is different based on the environment and also the airline's MRO strategies.
Looking at how you set up the learning journey, so we've touched on a couple of the research pieces that have aggregated the findings of your work on a couple of specific topics. That then has been upstreamed into this learning journey called on the site called FTI Aviation for our subscribers. Let's talk about how you put this together, what you chose to include, and really editorially, how you think about putting a piece like this together.
I think I've said this before. The learning journeys are ideally set to serve both types of people. Those that don't know FTI, and have some understanding about aerospace, and those that may know FTI a fair bit. And that's quite tricky. I've said this before, but it's quite tricky to serve, to create a structure and a learning journey where someone can get up to speed and it can be intuitive and they can understand it. You know, you obviously need a certain base level of knowledge. I'm assuming here, where that is kind of questionable, but it's a decent level. But if you understand aerospace and you've looked at industrials before, you should be able to navigate this if you haven't looked at FTI before at all. And you should also really find it hugely valuable if you're a shareholder of an FTI or, a long short or whatever an FTI. So the way it's structured is really just a reflection of it's called a learning journey because that's what it reflects. It reflects, our own learning journey. And, and that has to therefore navigate the value chain structure, market structure, structure of an engine, structure of a module, and then kind of get to the points that we've discussed, like those two hypotheses, which are the module factory and the module swap, and then the kind of PMA. But within those, if you look at how it's structured now, you've got certain points which are the USM and LLP availability, scale economies. So, I try to break out certain kind of concepts or topics or important points that also weave in and show really what matters for FTI. And this hopefully is just a reflection of our own learning journey, but can also be read in conjunction with the two other analysis pieces that go into way more detail on those two hypotheses that we mentioned. Why is the module swap unique and the addressable market, and also then the PMA side?
When you're putting these together, if I were to play devil's advocate and put myself in the shoes of someone that's maybe recently signed up to our service or that's evaluating the work that we're doing and the value, the potential value of these learning journeys, how do I know you're not going to send me down some rabbit hole or lead me to focus on something that's not that relevant? What can you tell me about your process here that would allow me to get any confidence in your ability to synthesize months of fieldwork, to conduct months of fieldwork and then synthesize it in a way that's actually useful to me, in a way that actually saves me time?
There's two parts of it. There's why should you even trust this full stop? Anything we do. Right. And then there's the synthesis and the curation and is that a distraction and misleading to some extent? On the first point, I'm not sitting here coming up with my own ideas necessarily. We source the best executives in the industry to help us understand these assets and these businesses. So it's a mix between our judgment and experience, but mainly from really finding the best executives and helping us understand how these businesses really work. And the learning journey comes out of the insights and the knowledge from these executives that we then curate into a journey. Now, there is a huge amount of judgment potentially that comes into this, to where you even direct your resources. Why? Who do I even speak to in the first place? Right? And you know, why am I, you know, should I spend 50 hours on the USM side of the business? You know, or should I really try and find people in the module factory or customers? And you know, this is the you know, hopefully the experience that we have after 2,000 hours of these, and God knows how long in terms of preparation for them, that hopefully enables us to direct our team and our resources most effectively to source those insights from executives. But fundamentally, these learning journeys are a curation of insights and knowledge from these executives that we then weave together to save you time. They're supposed to be an efficient tool for you to get up to speed and understand the core drivers of an investment thesis, and then leave it up to you to make a judgment on whether you think this is interesting or not. You know, there should probably be further work for you to do beyond that. This is not a recommendation by any stretch of the imagination. So hopefully this just makes it much more efficient, and the 40-50k we spend on doing primary research on FTI is just being rolled up into 2 hours of work, you know, for someone who wants to jump in and read this.
Yeah, with links to the original source material in the form of all of the underlying interviews that have been curated, that makes its way into these pieces. Now, again, taking the perspective of someone that is skeptical, and it's a really legitimate skepticism. I really want to respect those who are extremely uncomfortable with the idea that someone else might shape your thinking on something, or relying on a third party to do anything beyond, you know, present factually accurate information. So that there's a really legitimate concern that people have, which is, I don't want to outsource my thinking. I don't want to outsource heavy lifting. Let's talk about how we've learned to approach this in a way that might speak to that.
There are many layers to that, right? And so firstly, look, we're not sharing opinions. The work aims to typically curate how a business operates. You know, in this case, how a module swap works. Now, that is fairly objective, and obviously it's not perfect, because there's, like I said, every engine's different. Every airline has a different MRO strategy. Every engine flies in a different environment. So there's no objective truth and definitive answer to how a module swap works. It depends on the situation. But from our research, we can help you understand and transport you into Lockheed's factory to understand how an engine comes into the shop and how a module swap is executed by FTI. What we don't do is tell you what that, you know, what the EBITDA margin is going to be in 5 years and what we think that's going to be. You know, we try to tell you how this works, and then the judgment we have is how we lay out our work. So for example, engine book value. Well, why is that interesting? Why do we include that? You know, and that's part of the judgment that we make based on the conversations that we have in our research process. And so one insight, and therefore, what's the judgment that we make? Well, we have to have the ability to understand when something is a potentially an insight that's worthy of putting out and have it and structuring in this way. So for example, engine book value. One insight from someone who spent 7 years buying engines all day, simple insight was that the engine book value is driven by the cost of the maintenance of the engine. So the engine is worth zero if you have to go and spend, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10 million on repairing it all, right? So that's very interesting to consider if you are looking at the return on capital for FTI. So we're not necessarily sitting here, you know, coming up with these kind of the engine book value driven by the maintenance, but we have to have the judgment and the experience and the understanding to understand that is relevant and an insight that is worthy of putting out there like that. So, you know, it's probably, maybe that's not a clear answer, but there's many layers I'm very conscious of when, what's the level of subjectivity or judgment that we put into these pieces versus what is as close to objective truth as possible.
Well, and I think it becomes really important for listeners, subscribers, prospective subscribers to, and why we're quite willing to invest time as we are doing right now in explaining how we do this work, how we conduct the work, in explaining our process and what a fieldwork-driven process actually is. Because when you are purchasing an in-practice subscription or using our service, it's very hard to do that with any confidence without understanding our process. And we've historically allowed the work to speak for our process. We've spoken through the published work, which ultimately, if you read anything we do, everything we're talking about now reveals itself through the actual material we publish. But on that level, I like what you said about your answer. You know, you can't fit it into a soundbite or one or two sentences. Talk more about this fieldwork-driven process and our approach to thinking about authority and where authority comes from in making editorial decisions. I think that's really important. And it's quite different from a way a lot of investment funds operate.
This is supposed to be the furthest thing from a sell-side report or, frankly, any other thing you might find in your research house may produce. And look, there's a reason why we have further research questions at the end of this. Like, this is not a definitive piece of work by any means. This is, you know, it's a learning journey. The journey doesn't end, right? And so the way I look at this is really, I mean, ultimately it's what I would want, you know, partly what I would want to read, but it's also, it's helping investors get way more efficient in understanding a business and in helping them, you know, saving them time and money as well, right? Like, we spent 50K on FTI. You can then go and pick off certain things you might find interesting with the level of base knowledge from 20 hours of FTI interviews that we've curated in one go. So it's really meant to be, you know, it's in partnership with our subscribers that we kind of do this work. It's not like we're publishing something and that's a definitive piece and that's it. You read that and you're finished and you make a decision. No, this is supposed to be step one in the process. You know, step two in the process for investors, and they go and build on that. They might do some private calls. They might do some of their own calls. They might go and speak to anyone else. And that's therefore, you know, we're not trying to sell anything or tell anyone anything. It's supposed to be, it's called learning journey for a reason. Journey doesn't stop.
The journey doesn't stop, that these pieces are continuously evolving. They're upgraded over time, or upgraded, I should say, there's more included in the piece as we uncover more, as we publish more work. We periodically add that to the learning journeys. And I think to emphasize a couple of things you've said, one is that these pieces are works in progress, rooted in readings of the filings and then conversations with operators ruthlessly focused on how something works and on coming into relationship with the truth around how something works. And then there's an editorial component here. And there's something really important to say, which is this is by investors for investors. That I think, I mean, we could joke about it, but this isn't much use to the people that, to our peers. And if this wasn't run by an investor, I don't think we'd have a business. Right.
But it's, you know, back to your point on, like, there's huge power in just laying out how something works. It sounds so simple, but it's actually so difficult. You know, and you take a module swap or like repairing an engine, like, it's hugely complex. Not even the, like, it's not even the engineering, like, just it's hugely complex. I mean,
it's something that people can take large chunks of a career learning to master in the field, right? It can be pretty easy to forget this when you've got access to experts on tap, and, you know, within a couple of days you can speak to 10 people as an investor, right? That actually,
like, for example, in this situation where it's just by laying out how a module swap works, or how FTI runs a module factory, i.e. a module swap for an engine, part of the insight that came out of this work was when and how airlines swap certain modules. So you've got three modules. You've got an LP, you've got a fan, a core, and an LPT. Now, each module has different cycles. A cycle is a takeoff and a landing, and they all have different cycles. So an engine, when it hits the shop, has different cycles on different modules, therefore has different repair MRO strategies to repair and maintain each module. And part of the insight potentially that came out of this work was FTIR is specifically good and focused, and airlines really use them on the LPT module, not so much on the core module. What do you call engine repair then? You're just LPT repair. It's very different than engine repair. So just by laying out something or trying to lay out something, and look, don't get me wrong, like it's by no means perfect. I'm sure I missed a bunch and some slightly incorrect or not perfect, but just by, I think it's directionally correct, where just by laying out and trying to lay out how a module swap works, you potentially really understand what FTIR are doing, which is mainly focused on LPTs. And then that changes, you know, that's a pretty important data point that you might not specifically get from the filings or management directly. And then you get into a conversation about how that may impact future module demand and it influences a lot on how you look at the valuation and future organic growth of the business. So I think it's not to be underestimated how hard it is just to walk through something and how something works from first principles without any baggage or without any priors, and just really trying to understand something and not forcing a certain thesis or hypothesis on it, and letting these insights come out of it that can then determine, you know, where you take the research process from there.
Well, and that leaves us with a last point coming out of that I'd emphasize, which is the evergreen nature of the work and our journey in learning that as much as we want to, you know, we'd love to tell people, oh, we're going to publish X number of pieces in the next 3, 6, 12 months. We try to give people a sense directionally, but you can't force a piece, that you can't force an insight, that an insight arises out of the pursuit of a process. And what I found, I think, is what's given us any chance of publishing at the level we have is that you spend so much time on a number of businesses over periods of years. You spend time working on industries over periods of years, that your approach isn't, I've got 6 weeks, I've got to find something out to take back to a PM, you know, and persuade, or I'm going to give myself 2 months and I'm going to come back and persuade a bunch of people that I've figured out something and I'm really smart on this topic, right? It's actually inverting, and it's really important. I'm really keen on our community understanding that we actually work in a way that is often the inverse of the way investment research and or research analysts work, investment analysts work. And that is to say, we'll pick an industry, we'll pick a business. We've explained in other episodes and elsewhere why we might be drawn to certain kinds of businesses and industries. Where we do think there is something interesting, it's a journey over often several years. And for that matter, we try not to pick anything to study that we don't think we can study profitably for a decade. But it's to make this point, hopefully very clearly, that you are not trying to force some intellectual conclusion or some hypothesis over a period of months, that you're actually flipping the process. We are actually flipping the process. We're training our staff, Alan, Nadim, investment analysts that work for Impractice. We are rooted, our work is rooted in a philosophy and an approach to work that seeks to understand what's true, and the chips fall where they do. And either the work generates an insight over a period of months, or I think there's some things that we could talk about that you've been working on for a couple of years where I think you'd be quite happy to say that you don't have a deep insight or something to offer that's really incremental to what can be learned in filings or what, you know, existing shareholders of certain businesses might know pretty well.
I think whether luck is the right word, but we're quite lucky that we've found an infrastructure where we can pursue a certain style of learning that gives us that freedom to surface these insights without any requirement to confirm priors or force any judgment at any one point in time. And I say that, but we just missed, you know, I was 18 months late on what I've tied. So, you know, that's maybe a drawback of running an operating business. But I think over time, you know, if we just do this work seriously and focus on how stuff works, these insights will reveal themselves, and hopefully we can structure them and present them in a certain way that is intuitive and helpful for our customers.
Well, and a note to our listeners that we've listed a set of further research questions at the bottom of the learning journey, as we always do. If you have any comments on these questions, those research questions indicate where the next 10, 20, 30K of our research budget will go on this topic. Get in touch.
I'd also be interviewing people on customers. So we're actually working on customers of FTI now. And there's be a bunch of work on airline customers coming up and why they use FTI and how they use them. So further work on this.
I'd add that we also have published learning journeys on TransDigm, Lore, Heiko in aerospace, where we also list our further research questions. So if you want to give us feedback or want to chat about these questions, we deeply welcome your email or phone call.
As always, this is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for investment decisions. Please do your own research.